I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Patrick Ryan, the global head of banking and credit at Simpson Thacher and Bartlett. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So we're going to talk about your practice today and how the development in your practice and your career has paralleled the evolution of banking and finance markets. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to be a lawyer.
Sure. So I was born in the Bronx. I'm proud to say I'm a New Yorker. But my parents were immigrants from Ireland, and they moved back to Ireland. So I was raised in Ireland from the age of 2 to 17. I think sometimes when I talk about it, I may have the accent a little bit. So I was there through the end of high school, knew that I was born in New York, wanted to come back, wanted to see, if you will, where my birthplace was. So I came back to go to college. I did do a year of graduate school in economics back at Trinity College in Dublin, then came back to go to law school. And I think in my mind, I'd always thought of myself as a lawyer. I never really fantasized about being a doctor or maybe a little bit about being a priest, but that was normal for kids growing up in Ireland, at least for some. And I did flirt with banking. So I think ultimately my practice, which is focused on banking and credit or corporate finance, is a great merger of the two interests that I had growing up, with law being at the forefront of what I chose to focus on.
And what was the state of the finance markets when you started practice? Who provided the financing, and how did that financing get from, in those days, it was almost always banks, to the borrower?
So it's interesting because one of the first choices I had to make was what law firm would I choose? And as I looked at the various law firms, and at the time, the law firms that were preeminent have changed a little bit over time. And that's a good thing. The market has changed for law firms in the same way that the market has changed generally over that period of time. So when I came to Simpson, there was a client called the bank, and the bank was the biggest client of the firm. And it was Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company. And a lot of the firms at that time, the larger firms, had banks associated with those law firms. Cravath, a chemical, Sherman and Sterling had Citi, Milbank had Chase, Davis Polk and JP Morgan. And, you know, that was kind of a bellwether for the practice at those firms. So I started, and Manufacturers Hanover was the bank, the biggest client of the firm. We had a generalist model. So really my focus on credit happened as a result of sort of a natural process. I started to do credit deals, did more credit deals. So by the time I began to focus on credit, you know, it was clear that the market was dominated by traditional banks. And the negotiation process was one that was a lot built on trust and relationship. But banks, by and large, dictated terms. And part of the implicit contract was if you needed a waiver or an amendment of those terms, you could come back to your banker and they would be accommodating if it made sense. And we did lots of amendments to lots of contracts. So you would have Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Seventh. You'd get up to 12 amendments sometimes in some deals. And then that started to change and the market began to evolve. But that was the landscape when I first started to practice. And I felt like I was doing what you would traditionally expect a bank lawyer to do.
And of course, one way the market changed was there were mergers among banks. And in the 1990s, Chemical and Manufacturers Hanover were merged out of existence as part of a general consolidation of even the large banks. So how did that change the practice?
Sure. So that's right. There was a process that went on, and I think, you know, preceded in part by the savings and loan crisis, which goes back into the 80s. And by the time that wave of mergers and consolidation had really finished, because the banking market in the US was largely disaggregated, there weren't a lot of national banks. And I remember at one point in the mid 90s, somebody saying to me that there were really only 17 major banks left in the market, 17. And, you know, some of those banks were in the process of buying other smaller regional banks to increase their deposit base. But that wave of consolidation had contracted the market. And at the same time, debt as a vehicle to finance transactions became more important because, guess what? Like, private equity sponsors, financial sponsors were starting to emerge again post-RJR and the little pause that seemed to happen after people started to digest what happened at the end of the 80s. Obviously, Drexel went bankrupt in the fall of 89. That was a huge driver. And so people had to look for other places to find money. You know, Drexel was a large enterprise in terms of providing, quote, junk bonds at the time. And it was natural that money managers would, I think, now hindsight is 2020, that they would figure out that, hey, we can make good returns by providing capital in this market. And that the institutional tranche was born out of that need. It's almost like it wasn't a dislocation, but it was a need in the market to access more capital.
And so how did that change your practice? And then talk a little bit about the beginnings of the Term Loan B market.
Yeah, I can remember a day, and I can remember the banker's name, but I won't say the banker's name. And I got a call and he said, I have a new product for you. And I was like, well, what is it? And it was unlike anything we had seen in many ways because it was a term loan tranche. It was small. It was back-end loaded in terms of amortization. And it was keyed to non-traditional banks who were yield-seeking investors who wanted to put capital to work. And they wanted to, once deployed, leave it deployed for as long as possible, assuming that there was no adverse credit event that happened over the life of that loan. And lo and behold, that first call and the calls that followed, that was the birth. Well, that may not have been the first deal. It wasn't the first deal, the first time that I had done that deal, but that was like the birth of it. It was in right there in the mid 90s, and it started slowly. And in the beginning, I would say that the institutional investors very much sort of piggybacked on the terms that the banks would negotiate because they were just a provider of capital, but weren't in a direct dialogue yet with the borrowers. They were facilitating. They were being plugged in to a capital structure to provide capital that was necessary in order to finance the transactions at hand. But that changed over time. And that market became big enough that, in essence, there was a dialogue that developed between the supply side, these funds, and the demand side, the borrowers. And that, in essence, over time, helped to lead to other developments, which we'll talk about, like covenant light and things of that nature.
So essentially, the banks get disintermediated, but private equity in the 90s has, in large part, return to being a more middle market enterprise after the buyouts of the late 80s that culminated in RJR, correct?
Yes, they started slowly again. The market kind of heals, you know, with stitches, you know what I mean? It kind of like after there's dislocation, and that's right, because there were smaller deals. Remember that the backdrop here, too, is that in the early 80s, they talked about the information superhighway. Nobody really appreciated what that meant at the time, that it was going to be the birth of tech, the birth of the internet, a whole new way of thinking about how we do commerce. And so when private equity in the 90s was still focused on traditional businesses, and the investment thesis to me for those financial sponsors was buying companies that were not well run or needed a reformation of their cost structure and could be rationalized, turned around, made more successful. And so they started picking off the companies that sort of fit that model and started to build on that over time.
And tech, PE doesn't really start investing in tech in a big way until the SunGard buyout in 2004, which is the first big club deal, which would become a standard transactional form in that 04 to 07 period.
Right. Because in SunGard, that's the first, and you exactly focused on it. That was a consortium deal. And what consortium deals brought with it was sponsors being able to see the terms that other sponsors were getting. So you had a natural coalescence of, oh, you get that, or we can get this. And there was an appreciation for how they had come at it from different points of view, largely with common themes, but they had ended up in different places depending on the back and forth in any given transaction. And in SunGard, if you remember in SunGard, that buyout was signed up with a reverse break fee, as I remember, but with no financing. And then they went out and actually got the financing. And that brought into play meaningfully. This had been an issue in some earlier buyouts like Toys R Us, which had preceded it, but a focus on certainty through close, right? We need to know that if we arrange this financing, that there's no daylight effectively between the obligation of the finance providers to close and our obligation to buy the asset. So that's right. How that SunGard conditionality was marketed. And it made a lot of sense. I remember people talking at the time, this hasn't been done before, but guess what? It makes sense. And that's part of that liberation of thinking. Because for a long time, the dialogue had come out of the banks. And now you're starting to see a dialogue which is being driven by borrowers' needs, borrowers' requirements. Here's what I actually need in the market, and can you get it for me? And, you know, lo and behold, you go to these investors and you're able to deliver this certainty, if you will, SunGard conditionality, our version of limited conditionality in the US, which quickly gained hold and became a standard. And it's not controversial, but it took a while for it to take hold.
So in the 80s, private equity bars were going to Milken. And so they were in large part circumventing the banks, correct? So that they were getting the terms they needed, but in a different way. Do I have that right?
I think that's a good way to think about it. The other way to think about it, as a matter of necessity, in order to generate the returns that they needed more leverage than banks were willing to accommodate. And, you know, at the time, most of that debt was contractually subordinate. And people would argue about those subordination terms. So you were looking at a layer of capital that didn't change the risk profile. Mm-hmm. For the banks. So you knock yourself out because it's quasi-equity. If you want to lever up more highly, I don't know, because it sort of predated, I started in 89, exactly how people analyzed it within the confines of regulatory constraints or things of that nature. But you were getting greater flexibility, because that's typical in the bond world, and you were getting more leverage than you would otherwise get. And that's what the B market eventually provided in many ways, even though a lot of that debt is pari passu.
And so what do we see after the lending market seize up in the summer of 2007, big ticket private equity within a period of weeks just stops? And then, of course, a year later, you get the great financial crisis, and it's really hard for anybody to borrow any significant amount of money.
So at that point, you realize it's like when the wheel stops turning, you know, the banks were all stuck with this forward bridge book that was much larger than they had anticipated, because most of what they'd underwritten had been underwritten on the assumption that it would be distributed into the market within the flex terms that they had. But nobody had anticipated a market disruption where effectively there weren't any buyers. So it wasn't necessarily a price issue. Maybe at some astronomical price, it was a price issue. So it just like everything got turned on its head. And I sort of remember at the time, people focusing on, for example, limited conditionality and saying, do we have to close? Well, yes, you have to close, because that's what SunGard was all about in many ways, was eliminating daylight. And I think people came away from the financial crisis sort of saying to themselves, well, we should learn some lessons here, okay? Depending on which side you're on, either borrower side or lender side, there's some lessons to be learned here. And everyone kind of went away, waited for the re-engagement, and then bring back to that re-engagement what you think you've learned before. And right before the crisis, Covenant Life had started. And I think for me, Covenant Light, when you think about, let's go back to sponsors for a minute. They're all about buying businesses and changing those businesses, you know, whether it's eliminating costs, whether it's forward-looking run rate revenue initiatives. It's all about changing the business. You're not buying it to run it as it is, fundamentally changing it. And as a result, the financial covenants had a lot of architecture because you couldn't look at historical EBITDA because it meant nothing, because you were going to change the whole business. So you had to look at this adjusted EBITDA. And all these adjustments worked their way into EBITDA. So by the time, in my mind, the first Covenant Light deals started to clear the market, I think investors realized that those covenants weren't necessarily worse a lot. They were hard to understand, hard to handicap. The banks understood them. The banks could do that. But if you're a fund, you really didn't. So you traded the covenant for yield. So you got more yield, which is what you were really after. And then you kind of relied upon the market to otherwise make good decisions and ratings to make good decisions about leverage. So Covenant Light had started, then it completely stopped. And now we waited for the re-engagement post-financial crisis.
So talk to me a little bit about Flex. Was Flex always a part of the syndicated bank lending market, or was that something that appeared at some point?
It appeared, I'm trying to recall whether or not it was exactly at the same time as the institutional market had sort of taken hold, but roughly around that time. And I think it was a reflection in my mind that the market was a young market at the time, and perhaps it was hard to gauge exactly where pricing would end up in the market. You always wanted, as a bank, to deliver the best possible execution that you could. But you needed to have some backstop if the market moved or something happened, so that if you're underwriting a large amount of debt for a highly leveraged or relatively highly leveraged acquisition, you needed to have some ability to change the economics, to change the pricing, to change some of the other terms, to dial it back in order to help you to syndicate if you needed it. So it was a natural outgrowth of the institutional market, David.
And so picking up in the great financial crisis and thereafter, private equity, at least for the time being, is focused largely on dealing with the challenges of running its businesses and can't sign up large buyouts in any event. But the corporate market is the first to return with Pfizer Wyeth. So tell us about that deal and how the corporate market post-financial crisis was different from or similar to the way it was pre-financial crisis.
Right. I think that everyone sort of wondered how the market would repair itself. There's a certain amount of price discovery that needs to happen as part of a return of the market. And invariably, with all of these disruptions, the market sort of heals itself by rolling out some of the better stories, some of the better narratives first. That's where the price discovery, in my mind, kind of happens. And post the financial crisis, you know, Pfizer Wyeth, very good industry, you know, healthcare, pharma, dependable cash flows, large dollar amount. And those were, you know, on balance, probably more lender favorable. And they should be as the market sort of healed and returned. And those deals, there was a few that followed, they actually were well received in the market. And that's what the market needed, was some sense that things were going to go back to normal relatively quickly, albeit at wider pricing, perhaps in different terms initially than pre-crisis. But let's get the engines kind of rolling again. And after Pfizer Wyeth, there were a number of other strategic investment grade deals. And then it spills over into sort of the leverage world. And that playbook has kind of played itself out a number of times as the market tries to figure out how it's going to reconstitute a normal practice for the market.
And then also post-financial crisis, banks become limited in their ability to fund middle market private equity deals, which were almost all of the private equity deals going on at that point. And so you get the beginnings of the direct lending market. So tell us about that and then how the direct lending market then evolves.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the private credit market, the direct lending market, initially was focused on the marginal credits in the market. And I don't mean to use marginal in the sense of disparaging those businesses at all, but ones that didn't have the high dollars and attract a lot of attention. But nonetheless, they needed money, they needed credit, they needed leverage. And those private credit lenders were starting small. They weren't showing up with billions of dollars. They were showing up with, you know, tens of millions and finding good companies with EBITDA that was below a threshold that would attract a lot of attention. And they started to lend to those companies smaller deals. And as a result, the law firms that sort of focused on that market were not the traditional high-end firms in the beginning. And they went hand in hand with the private credit folks as they started to lend. They generate returns. Those returns encourage investors to give them more money. And they slowly creep up the scale in terms of being able to provide more money for bigger transactions. And now in the private credit market, you are seeing them provide commitments for acquisitions in the billions of dollars. And it is a source of financing that most borrowers will look at as an alternative. And it offers more certainty at a higher price potentially in the long term as compared to a syndicated deal. But that's generalizing, so it's not necessarily true 100% of the time. But private credit is here to stay. It is definitely going to be an increasingly important part of the market going forward.
And what are its advantages and disadvantages compared to the syndicated bank lending market? And how do the banks respond to private credit? How are they responding?
Okay, so I think they offer a number of things. In some ways, it harkens back to sort of relationship lending, which was a key part of the banking market that I alluded to earlier, the kind of trust me component. I'm not sure it's exactly that, but they are sort of relationship lenders. They tend to focus more on individual credits. They're not ratings based. They're not sort of portfolio investors. They will learn a lot about their borrowers. They will have tighter covenants generally, but the debt that they put in place is typically not widely syndicated. So if you need an amendment, you can go back and get an amendment from those lenders. So they also offer greater confidentiality and things of that nature because you're not reporting and providing information to a wide group of lenders. And in the syndicated market, you have this concept of disqualified lenders as borrowers have focused on who is getting my information, who is getting sensitive information, who is voting as part of my lender syndicate. So you're really getting that touch and feel relationship lending, even though you're not going through a traditional bank. And you're not taking market risk, but you're paying for that because in a normal non-disrupted market, you would expect that private credits will price a little bit higher or higher than the syndicated counterpart. And I think that will hold up over time. And what the syndicated product will have set pricing with flex, how the fully flex pricing compares to private credit at any particular point in time can vary. But for example, in the most recent disruption that we've experienced, starting obviously with inflation and with the war in Ukraine, the syndicated markets have really gapped out fairly widely and significantly and impacted new issuance in a significant way as the market has largely adopted a wait and see approach in terms of where inflation settles, where monetary policy settles, what the supply chain issues are. There's a lot to be resolved there. The private credit side of things, they haven't gapped out as much, if much at all, in terms of pricing. And part of what they're doing, I think, is continuing to lend to some of the better credits, the better narratives than the wide syndicated market. Now, that's not necessarily completely true, but they're not up to the point where they're looking to provide credit to everyone at this point. And so it's been a source of credit that has held up better, I would say, in this most recent disruption. But again, there are limits to the amount that can be accessed through that channel.
And as you look out 3 to 5 years, how do you see the relationship between direct lending and the bank syndicated market?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, banks are always going to be a major part in the market, and they're always going to be adapting and thinking about how to position themselves to best provide the financing that their clients need. And you ask, how are they responding? Well, I think they are responding, and they're starting to look at providing credit that more closely resembles what private credit looks like. I think that's emerging within the bank constituency. So over time, if you talk about it, these two universes will exist side by side. They will be very similar to each other in many ways. And one might expect that they will converge over time. And that convergence may take the form of banks and large private credit lenders teaming up to do larger deals, which they've already started to do, and doing that sort of over and over again as the need for capital continues to be there. There's a lot of debt that's been placed. It needs to be refinanced. And we are in a transformational period in our economy. There's still a lot of M&A that needs to happen, that needs to be financed. And I don't think we're at a point yet where we have more debt than the market can use. So there's room for everybody.
And then finally, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you grew up in Ireland. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, your relationship with the country where you grew up? Do you go back a lot? You know, do you feel connected to the culture?
I do. I go back very often. In fact, people ask me about my accent, and my mother is still there. She just turned 90, and I go back to visit her, and I seem to recapture my youthful personality and accent when I go back. So it's always going to be a part of me. It's always going to be something that I remember fondly. I support, you know, the Irish soccer team as well as the U.S. soccer team. I follow local sports. I have lots of friends there. I have lots of family there. So I always feel welcome. I love going back. I love bringing my kids back. And I think that'll always be a feature. It's a richness that I think I'm lucky enough to have, and I don't intend to let that go. I'm also an avid golfer, so golfing in Ireland is close to nirvana for some.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Very happy. Thank you for having me, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.